We barely got into 1 Samuel chapter 13 last time. We only read about half of the chapter, so in a moment we're going to read the entire chapter together. But first, let's get our bearings. Shaul was now the recognized and undisputed king of Israel. However, his main support, his loyalty, came from those 8 northern tribes, and to some degree those 3 tribes that were east of the Jordan. And the 2 southern tribes of Judah and Simeon weren't necessarily opponents of Saul, but they were rather ambivalent. And Saul must have recognized that fact. So his recruiting for his military came mainly from that loyal group of 8 tribes up north. Now, as we pick up today, we're at a time just after Saul has neutralized the main, or at least the most immediate, foreign threat that was on Israel's eastern front. That was the Ammonites, as led by Nahash. We read about this back in chapter 11. But on the western front, the Philistines had grown bolder. They'd grown more aggressive. And by means of the carrot and the stick, they had again established a significant presence upon Israelite land. Now, the stick, well, that was their professional and their well-trained army. And they used it to oppress and control and to threaten. Now, the carrot was that any of these Israelite tribes and clans who would not resist them would be considered either allies or non-combatants, and thus generally they were left alone to continue ruling themselves, living peacefully. Now, naturally, they had to do the Philistines' bidding. They had to provide some labor for various Philistine projects. Occasionally, they had to fight alongside of them. And, of course, always, they had to pay taxes to the Philistines. Now, there's no record of Saul taking vengeance at this point in his reign against these few Israelite tribes and clans who availed themselves of the Philistines' offer of friendship in exchange for loyalty. And a couple of reasons for this are that, first, it was generally only the southern tribes and clans who did this, because the Philistines were on their border, and so they were always in the most danger. And second, it is that Saul understood it was an arrangement of self-interest and self-protection, not so much a repudiation of Saul's leadership or a desire for them to give up their Israelite identities. And besides, King Saul still wasn't quite at a point of sufficient political strength to convince the other tribes to punish the highly regarded and esteemed tribe of Judah for this transgression. Well, as it is in most societies, while the leadership might be anxious to make war for one cause or another, the people usually aren't. Although, at times, maybe they ought to be. There's no question that Saul was correct in his calculation that the Philistines had to be dealt with, or Israel was just going to become part of some greater Philistia. But convincing people who just wanted to farm, they just wanted to tend their flocks and their vineyards, well, to teach them that armed conflict was going to be needed in this, well, that's another matter. We only have to look at the 20th century, now the 21st, to see how long tyrants with world domination in mind were allowed to run amok before some of the more powerful nations could finally muster the political will to oppose them. And even then, typically the people were reluctant, and all through the wars, vocal opposition would continue. As was also typical, Saul's sons were his senior army officers. Jehonatan, Jonathan, was apparently the most prominent of the bunch. And King Saul had begun a campaign to push those Philistines back to their seacoast nation on the Mediterranean. And so he had troops stationed at Gibeah under Jonathan's leadership. And others were strategically located in a very important place called Michmash. The campaign now had bogged down for lack of interest of the Israelite people, and because the Philistines had been pretty careful not to get overly aggressive in hopes of not arousing too much Israelite passion, would then boil over into open rebellion. Now, what they didn't count on was Saul's impulsiveness and his personal need to find a cause to rally all Israel to loyalty to him. Now, Jonathan, being part of that royal family, well, he shared his father's ambitions and his mindset. So he assassinated the Philistine governor of the city of Geba for no other purpose than to incite the Philistines to step up their aggression that would in turn force the up to now reluctant Israelite clan and tribal leaders to join with Saul to fight against those Philistines. So let's pause now and let's read all of 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 310. Shaul was some number of years old when he began to reign, and he had ruled Israel for 2 years when he chose 3,000 of Israel's men. 2,000 of them were with Shaul at Michmash and in the hills of Beit El, and 1,000 were with Jehonatan in Gevat Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent back to their respective tents. Now, Jonathan assassinated the governor of the Philistines in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. So Shaul had the shofar sounded throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard that Shaul had assassinated the governor of the Philistines, and thus made Israel a stench in the nostrils of the Philistines. So the people rallied behind Shaul in Gilgal. And while the Philistines assembled themselves together to make war on Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, an army as large as the number of sand grains on a seashore, they came up and pitched camp at Michmash, east of Beit Aven. And the men of Israel saw that their options were limited, and that the people felt so hard pressed that they were hiding themselves in caves, thickets, crevices, watchtowers, cisterns. And while some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan to the territory of Gad and Gilead, but Shaul was still in Gilgal, where all the people were eager to follow him. Well, he waited 7 days, as Samuel had instructed, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal. So the army began to drift away from him, and Saul said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he had finished sacrificing the burnt offering, there was Samuel. He had come. And Shaul went out to meet and greet him. Shmuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Well, I saw that the army was drifting away from me, that you hadn't come during the time appointed, and the Philistines had assembled at Michmash, and I said, now the Philistines will fall on me at Gilgal, and I haven't asked the favor of Adonai, so I forced myself, and I offered the burnt offering." And Shmuel said to Shaul, "You did a foolish thing. You didn't observe the mitzvah of Adonai, which he gave you. If you had, Adonai would have set up your kingship over Israel forever, but as it is, your kingship will not be established. Adonai has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and Adonai has appointed him to be prince over his people, because you did not observe what Adonai ordered you to do." Then Samuel left Gilgal and went up to Gibeah Benjamin. Saul counted how many there were still with him, about 600 men. And Shaul, Jehonatan his son, and the men with him took up quarters at Gibeah Benjamin, while the Philistines remained in camp at Michmash. Then raiding parties began coming out from the camp of the Philistines, three of them. One group turned towards the road leading to Ophrah in the territory of Shual. Another group took the road towards Beit Horon. Another company took the road towards the desert through the territory overlooking the Vadi Zvoim. Now, there was no metalsmith to be found anywhere in all the land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, we don't want the Hebrews making themselves swords or spears. So whenever any of the people of Israel wanted to sharpen his hoe, his plowshare, his axe, or his pick, he had to go down to the Philistines, where the exorbitant prices were 2/3 of a shekel for filing a pick or a plowshare, and 1/3 of a shekel for filing an axe or setting an ox goad in his handle. Thus, when the time came to fight, no one in the army of Shaul and Jehonatan were equipped with either sword or spear, although Saul and Jonathan, his son, did have them. A garrison of the Philistines had gone out to the pass of Michmash. Now, Jonathan's murder of the Philistine governor of Geba had its desired effect. The Philistines now saw this as open rebellion, not just an act of a local group of malcontents, but rather as a work of King Saul, who represented the nation of Israel. Therefore, as the Philistines ratcheted up their pressure, the people of Israel realized they now had no choice but to resist. So they assembled at Gilgal, ready for battle. Why Gilgal? Because it was typical of the Israelites to gather at their holiest place to ask for Jehovah's blessing and direction before engaging the enemy. Now, verse 5 says that the Philistines brought 30,000 chariots to do battle. This is a copyist error. There probably weren't 30,000 chariots in the entire known world combined at this point in history. And the number probably wasn't 3,000 either, because even that quantity of chariots is beyond the scope of the relatively small nation as Philistia to have in its arsenal. So it would be only speculation to say how big of a chariot brigade they must have had. Nonetheless, it was formidable. There were many troops on horses. This was only slightly less terrifying than chariots. And some large but undefined number of foot soldiers as well. Now, let me pause to say that whether regarding foreigners, Hebrews, or worshipers of God in general, when we see in the Bible the phrase, as many as the grains of sand on a seashore, this is just hyperbole. Okay, it's a Middle Eastern saying. It just means a really big number. It doesn't mean infinite. It doesn't mean beyond the ability of our number system to count it. It's just trying to communicate a very large but imprecise unknown quantity. Now, the Philistines set up their battle encampment at a place called Michmash, which was a bit east of Beit Aven. Now, many Israelites were so terrified at this turn of events that they left their homes and villages, hid out in caves, in crevices of large rocks, even in empty water cisterns. Others of them fled to the Transjordan, undoubtedly many of them having relatives there that were willing to take them in for a while. But those men who came to fight for Saul, well, they remained strong and with resolve, and so they stayed with Saul at Gilgal as they waited for Samuel to show up, in hopes that he would bring God's oracle to them before the start of what would be a great and pivotal battle. Now, apparently Saul was told by Samuel that he was going to arrive at Gilgal within 7 days. Seven being a number of divine completeness is a way of demonstrating that this looming war was seen by God as a holy endeavor. But from a practical matter, we must remember that Samuel lived in Ramah, so it was going to take some time for him to travel from there to Gilgal. Now, before we go any further, I want to explain that there's a lot of confusion between the two names of Geba and Gibeah. Okay, some translators have taken them to be the same place, but that is not the case. The problem is, you see, they're both spelled the same in Hebrew, Gimel Vet Ein. And since ancient Hebrew doesn't have written vowel sounds, then this confusion is the case with a number of Hebrew words that are written the same, but then they're pronounced slightly differently, thus giving them different meanings. In this case, what we in English say as Gibeah is actually more pronounced something like Geba, Geba. The other location that we usually pronounce as Geba, the Hebrews pronounced Geba. So we have Geba and Geba. Jonathan was in Geba when he assassinated the Philistine governor. Anyway, Saul grew impatient while he was waiting for Samuel to arrive in Gilgal. The 7 days came, they went, no Samuel. So Saul took matters into his own hands. There was an altar. There was also a sanctuary at Gilgal. So King Saul decided he'd be the one to offer sacrifices to the Lord. Now, without doubt, there were priests at Gilgal because of its very holy status. But King Saul demonstrates here his casual disregard for God's commandments and his ritual protocols. The only Israelites legally allowed to offer sacrifices were priests. Not even the Levite workers were allowed to do this. Certainly no king, the political leadership, was allowed this high privilege. But even more we see, if we properly translate the original Hebrew, it is that Shaul ordered that the Olah and the Shlamim offerings were to be brought to him so he could personally officiate over them. The Olah is the supreme offering. It is to be offered up only by the high priest. The Shlamim sacrifices were voluntary offerings that, while technically could only be officiated by priests, were regularly offered up by laymen as family-oriented sacrifices, a kind of holdover from days long past when each family's firstborn was the officiator of sacrifices and each family usually had their own altar. And wouldn't you just know that King Saul offered the one sacrifice that only the high priest was allowed to present to God, the Olah. And of course, no sooner does he do this than Samuel shows up and essentially says, "What in the heck do you think you're doing?" And Saul's answer in verse 11 was, well, he was getting worried because many of his Israeli militia were packing up and going home right at the same time the Philistines were building up their forces at Michmash and Samuel hadn't arrived. And so he continues to explain to Samuel that he forced himself to perform this sacrifice in order to gain the necessary favor with God. Well, Samuel has no patience for this. And he retorts that King Saul did a foolish thing by daring to go against Jehovah's Torah commandments simply because he felt it would be more expedient. But this indictment of Shaul by Samuel now takes on the form of a judgment. The judgment is, your kingship will not be established. That does not mean that the Lord is canceling Saul's kingship. It means Saul's son won't succeed him. There will be no dynasty of Saul. And this was always paramount in the king's mind, that his family continues on in power after him for generations. Now, there's a lot of disagreement by scholars over exactly what mitzvah, what command, Shaul had foolishly broken. Now, literary critics in particular say the problem was that King Saul was usurping Samuel's role when he offered the sacrifice as a preface to holy war, and that Samuel was jealous and he was upset. Others say it was because Saul had broken Samuel's instructions to wait 7 days for him. A few claim the problem was that Saul didn't properly acknowledge the Samuel prophet's higher role as the divine messenger of God. Frankly, these proposals are kind of tortured. Right? It's a strange way of getting around the obvious just so a scholar can sound innovative. In verse 12, Saul admits that he personally officiated the Olah sacrifice, to which in verse 13, Samuel responds, "You did a foolish thing. You didn't observe the commandments of God." It was Saul, a non-priest, presumptuously offering the greatest of all the sacrifices to the Lord that was the foolish thing. It was a very clear and specific Torah commandment that Saul was breaking. That only priests could offer sacrifices. Only the high priest, apparently Samuel as well, could offer the highest sacrifice, the Olah. Further, while we'll later see David, Solomon, and other kings speak about the many sacrifices they offered as a means to prove their personal piety, we see that what they meant by that was that they provided the sacrificial animals, or they were personally present at the ceremony. Priests were always involved. But here we specifically see that Saul actually performed the ritual sacrifice himself without a priest when he said, "I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." And the price for this rash and unlawful act on King Saul's part is really severe. Now, it's interesting. We find utterly no response from Saul to this devastating judgment against him. No remorse, no argument, nothing. Instead, the king just went around his business as usual. What are we to think of this? Well, I take it to mean that Saul just blew it all off. I take it to mean that Saul thought that basically this was kind of just a personal feud between him and Samuel, and that was all going to blow over in time. But Samuel also told Saul that God had already decided on a replacement king, and it was going to be a man after his own heart, meaning after his own mind, his own way of thinking. It will be a man whose goals are God's goals, whose passions are God's passions. Once again, we encounter a Hebrew term that is translated in English usually as prince. That term is nagid. It's an important term because we're going to later see in the prophetic statements about the Messiah that it also calls him a prince, a nagid. It means a king in waiting. The designated future king, but not yet king. Now, we know from what happens in the coming chapters of 1 Samuel that the designated future king is going to be David. We also know from the New Testament that the designated future king that is also Messiah is Yeshua. Now, later actions by Saul prove, I believe, my suggestion that Saul never took what Samuel said very seriously. Or perhaps he was simply so innately rebellious that he thought he had the power to thwart any attempt for another to take the throne from him. Now remember my comments from the last lesson when I explained that the story of King Saul is essentially the story of the anti-king of Israel. So as we later get to the narratives of King Saul's desperate attempts to hang on to his throne and to kill God's Nagid, David, knowing full well that this was God's will because Samuel told him so. So we see this parallel with the attempt of this ancient spiritual anti-king, Satan, to do all he can to destroy God's spiritual Nagid, Messiah Yeshua, thinking he can thwart God's plan. But this kind of uneasy relationship between king and prophet, well, this would become the norm from here forward in Israel's history, and it's pretty easy to understand why. The heavenly king has his agenda, and the earthly king, who's just a fallen man, well, he has his own. The prophet presents the heavenly king's divine agenda to the earthly king, but the earthly king prefers his own. The conflict between king and prophet is inevitable. Well, after this clash with the king, Samuel departs for Geba, Samuel's hometown. And Saul took a count. Only about 600 men remained with him there at Gilgal. Now remember that Saul had very little leverage over his army. This was still a voluntary militia. And if the men decided they didn't want to fight, they didn't like the leadership, they got scared, they went home. Various translations have Saul leaving with Jonathan and the 600 men for Geba, the same place Samuel went. However, other translations have Saul and his men going to Geba. We already talked about all this name confusion. Geba is more correct. And we know this because of what is going to come soon. But in a nutshell, Geba was only a mile or so from Michmash, where the Philistines had set up their camp, and where the coming battle occurred. But Geba was at least 5 miles away. Events are going to show that the Philistine camp had to be right next to where Saul was located. And we're going to get to that part shortly. Well, the Philistines now send out 3 raiding parties. And their purpose was probably to project force by demonstrating control of the surrounding area such that they could march out anytime they wanted to. It was also to try and hunt down those troublemakers who were opposing them a little bit too strongly. One group went north towards the Jordan River Valley. Another one went west along the road to the coastal plain. And a third group went south towards the wilderness to see if any attack from that direction might be imminent. Well, then verse 19 detours us just a little bit to explain a very detrimental situation for the Israelites. They had few to no metal-edged weapons. The Philistines, on the other hand, were known for their high degree of metals technology, and they had used it to their advantage in weaponry. Now, iron was relatively new to the region, and it was a significant advance over bronze, which was a much softer material. That meant that a soldier could literally break his enemy's bronze sword with his much harder, sharper iron sword. Therefore, we see this high level of control that the Philistines achieved over some areas of Canaan, in that they were able to keep the Israelites from even possessing metal tool-making equipment. An iron-edged plow, even a bronze one, was far better than a wooden one. But in order for an Israelite to buy or even sharpen, let alone repair, a metal-edged farm implement, he didn't have a choice but to go to the Philistines, since the Hebrews were barred from this craft. This enabled the Philistines to keep the Israelites from making metal weapons. So whatever the Israelite militia was going to use in battle, it was going to be pretty inferior to the Philistine army equipment. Whatever metal weapons Israel did have were very typically given to their leaders. Thus we read in verse 22 that King Saul and his son Jonathan did have metal swords and spears. Well, the final verse of chapter 13 sets up the battle scene for chapter 14. A garrison of Philistines had gone out to the pass of Michmash. So now let's move on to chapter 14. We're not going to get real far, but we need to read this chapter as a whole so that we can get this story. Chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, page 311, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man carrying his armor, "Come on, let's go across to the garrison of the Philistines on the other side." But he didn't tell his father. Now Shaul was waiting on the far edge of Geba under the pomegranate tree in Migron. The force with him numbered about 600 men. Achiah, the son of Ahituv, Ichavod's brother, the son of Pinchas, the son of Eli, the Kohen of Adonai and Shiloh, he was carrying a ritual vest. Now, no one knew that Jonathan had gone. And between the passes by which Jonathan was trying to cross over to the garrison of the Philistines, there was a rocky spur on one side and another rocky spur on the other side. The one was named Bozetz, and the other was Sine. The one spur rose up on the north in front of Michmas, the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come on, let's go across to the garrison of these uncircumcised people. Maybe Adonai will do something for us, since Adonai can rescue with a few people as easily as with many." His armor bearer replied, "Do everything you think you should. I'm with you, whatever you decide." Yehonatan said, "Here, we'll cross over to those men and let them know we're there. And if they say, 'Wait till we come to you,' we'll stand where we are and we'll not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come on up to us,' or 'We'll go on up,' that will be the sign that Adonai has given us victory over them." So both of them let their presence be known to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, some Hebrews are coming out of their holes that they've been hiding in." Then the men of the garrison said to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us. We want to show you something." Jonathan told his armor bearer, "Come on up after me, because Adonai has handed them over to Israel." Jonathan climbed up. He used his hands as well as his feet with his armor bearer behind him. And the Philistines fell before Jonathan. And his armor bearer following him finished them off. That first slaughter of about 20 men was accomplished by Jonathan and his armor bearer in a space only half as long on one side as one side of a pair, of the area as a pair of oxen could plow in a day. There was panic in the field camp among all the Philistines, and likewise the garrison and the raiding party panicked. Besides all this, there was an earthquake. Thus it grew into a panic caused by God, and Saul's men on watch in Givat Benjamin could see the enemy camp scattering, running in all directions. So Shaul ordered the forces with him to call the roll and see who was missing. So they called the roll, and they found Yehonatan and his armor bearer were not present. Shaul told Achiah, "Bring the Ark of God here," for at that time the Ark of God was with the people of Israel. But while Shaul was talking to the Kohen, the uproar in the camp of the Philistim continued, and it kept getting louder. And Shaul said to the Kohen, "Put your hand down." Saul and the entire force with him assembled, and they went to battle. But they found the Philistines all fighting each other in utter confusion. The Hebrews from the surrounding countryside, who had previously been with the Philistines and had got up with them into the camp, deserted. They went over to Israel with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, on hearing that the Philistines were fleeing, all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hills of Ephraim pursued them in battle. So Adonai saved Israel that day, and the battle spread as far as Beit Aven. Well, Israel's soldiers had been driven to exhaustion that day, but Saul issued this warning to the people: "A curse on any man who eats any food until evening, when I have finished taking vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people even tasted food. Now the people came to a forest where there was a honeycomb on the ground. And when the people had entered the forest, they saw there the honeycomb with honey dripping out, but no one put his hand to his mouth because the people feared the oath. But Jonathan heard his father charging the people with the oath, so he put out the end of his staff in his hand, he dipped it in the honeycomb, and he raised it to his mouth, whereupon his eyes lit up. But one of the people said in response, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath. A curse on any man who eats any food today, and even though the people are fainting with hunger." And Jonathan answered, "My father has brought trouble to the land. Just look how my eyes have lit up because I tasted just a little of this honey. How much greater would the slaughter of the Philistines have been today then if the people had eaten freely of the spoil they found with their enemies?" That day they had attacked the Philistines from Michmas to Ayalon, but the people were very exhausted. So the people rushed at the spoil, seizing sheep and cows and calves and slaughtering them there on the ground and eating the flesh with the blood. And Saul was told, "Look how the people are sinning against Adonai, eating with the blood." He said, "You have not kept the faith. Roll a big stone to me immediately." "Now," Shaul said, "go around among the people and tell them, each of you is to bring his cow and sheep and slaughter them here. Then eat. don't sin against Adonai by eating with the blood. So each person brought his animal with him that evening and killed it there. Saul erected an altar to Adonai. It was the first altar that he erected to Adonai. And Shaul said, let's go after the Philistine by night. We'll plunder them until dawn. We won't leave one of them alive. And they answered, do whatever seems good to you. But the priest said, let's approach God here. And Shaul consulted God. Should I go down in pursuit of the Philistines? Will you hand them over to Israel? But he didn't answer him that day. And Saul said, come here, all you heads of the people. Think carefully. Who has committed this sin today? For as Adonai, Israel's deliverer, lives, even if it proves to be Jonathan, my son, he must be put to death. But no one among the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, you be on one side, I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people replied to Shaul, do what seems good to you. Shaul said to Adonai, the God of Israel, who's right? Jonathan and Saul were chosen by lot, and the people went free. Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. Jonathan was chosen. And Shaul said to Jonathan, tell me what you did. Jonathan told him, yes, I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff in my hand, and here I am. I'm ready to die. And Saul said, may God do the same to me and more if you also not put to death Jonathan. But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Heaven forbid! As Adonai lives, not one hair of his head will fall to the ground because he worked with God today. And in this way, the people rescued Jonathan so that he didn't die. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines returned to their own territory. So Saul took over the leadership, or the rulership of Israel. He fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon and Edom, the kings of Zobah and the Philistines. No matter which way he turned, he defeated them. He demonstrated his strength by attacking Amalek, and he saved Israel from the power of those who were plundering them. The sons of Saul were Jonathan, Yishvi, and Malchishua. The names of his two daughters were these, the name of the older, Merav, and the younger, Michal. Shaul's wife was named Ahinoam, and the daughter of Ahimaatz, the commander of his army, was named after Avner, the son of Ner, Shaul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, Ner the father of Avner, and the son of Aviel. As long as Shaul lived, there was bitter war against the Philistines. Whenever Saul saw any strong and courageous man, he recruited him into his service. Okay, look at the map. Geba and Michmas were on opposite sides of a very deep ravine. This ravine was cut by running water over the eons, but now was only a wadi. A wadi is a dry riverbed that occasionally comes alive only upon a strong rain. Often the water actually flows a few feet underground, so sometimes a shallow well can access water. But most wadis are just channels for water that comes temporarily from seasonal rains or thunderstorms, and then they go dry again. Well, Israel's military camp was on the south side of the ravine, the Philistines, the north side, about a mile apart. The ravine itself was of strategic importance because it wound its way all through the Jordan Valley, but also it provided a good pathway that connected to the road that led to the Mediterranean Sea coast. This wadi, this ravine, was a natural highway that was suitable for caravans or for even large groups of soldiers. So it was very strategically important to both sides. Verse 1 says that on that day, Jonathan made this daring proposal to his armor bearer. They should, just the two of them, go see what the Philistines were up to at Michmas. Now, a logical question is, what specific day is this referring to? There's two parts to the answer. First, it's referring back to chapter 13. Now remember, breaking the scriptures apart into chapters is kind of a modern invention, okay, where it says a garrison of Philistines had gone out to the pass of Michmash. The second part of the answer is that in the Bible, on that day or in that day doesn't necessarily mean this 24-hour period that we call a day today. It's more referring to the context of the specific situation. So we could paraphrase it like this. During the time that the Philistines had sent a garrison of soldiers and established a camp at Michmash, then they did thus and so. Well, it could have been a next day, it could have been a few days later, but it all had to do with the occasion of the garrison of the Philistines going to Michmash. But here we find a kind of formality where we're introduced to Jonathan. And it is made clear that King Saul is his father, and equally clear that Jonathan was just a chip off the old block. He was as headstrong, he was as impetuous as his father was, and so he told his armor bearer they ought to walk across that ravine and challenge those Philistines to come out and fight. Well, King Saul knew nothing about this foray, as he was back with his 600 troops in Geba, where he was camping under a pomegranate tree. Now, it was usual that a recognizable tree was where the military or governmental authority would station itself, because it was easier to describe to some large contingent of people where they could go find the leadership. In other words, in addition to it being a pretty prime camping spot that was always reserved for the elite, an exceptionally big tree was a good landmark. Now, since this was a holy war, naturally, Israel's high priest was present. And here we are told that the high priest was Ahiah, the great-grandson of Eli. Eli was Samuel's mentor from the time that Samuel was a little boy. And although it doesn't directly say that Ahiah was the Kohen, or better, the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, it tells us that he was wearing the ephod. The ephod was that special ritual vest that was symbolic of the high priest. By the way, as of this time, there were competing high priesthoods in existence. Eli's line wasn't of the proper lineage, and exactly how it came to be that Eli, and now his grandson Ahiah, was the high priest, or at least for some of the tribes it was, that's all open to debate. Now, and I think it's kind of interesting, watch how this issue of the high priest subtly plays out, but at the same time, it has a pretty significant role in Israel's history, even though it generally goes unnoticed, although as we go along in Samuel and Kings and so on, I'm going to point it out to you. Eli, and so his descendants, were of the line of Ithamar. This was the youngest son of Aaron. Ahiah was of Eli's, therefore of Ithamar's line, and therefore by the law of Moses, he had no right to the high priesthood. The high priesthood was supposed to go to the descendants of another son of Aaron, Eleazar. Somewhere along the line, a power struggle had taken place and Eli's family had won out. So here we have two high priests in existence, and King Saul has the opportunity to do what's right and to put the proper high priest back into power according to the laws of the Torah, but he didn't do it. King Saul instead decides that Ahiah was to continue on as his government's high priest. Now, here's the reason Paul made that decision. Eli's family was aligned with the 8-tribe northern coalition of tribes. And since Saul's tribe Benjamin was part of that same coalition, naturally, they would recognize Ahiah as their high priest and they would ignore the other one. And Saul wasn't about to rock this boat because he was mostly concerned with gaining loyalty from the people. But in a couple of chapters, when Saul dies and David becomes king, a new and different high priest suddenly springs onto the scene, Zadok. And guess what? Zadok is of the line of Eleazar. He is of the Torah-authorized line of high priests. Now, Zadok was certainly around and operating during Saul's day. In fact, he was Achiah's competitor. However, he was not recognized as high priest by the northern tribes for political reasons. But Zadok was recognized by the two southern tribes. David's tribe was the southern tribe of Judah, as the proper high priest. So it was logical that when David became king, he would set aside the northern coalition's high priest and he would install Zadok as the high priest for his government. Now, on the one hand, while this was certainly the divinely right thing for David to do, on the other hand, these things don't happen accidentally. And David actually made a political choice. And although the Bible doesn't explain the details about how some of these political and governmental changes all came about, nonetheless, it really helps for us to find out what was behind it. Because then we can see how God constantly moves, hidden, unseen, in his providence in the lives of men, balancing things out, bringing about his will, advancing history towards redemption, eventually punishing the wicked, vindicating the righteous, even though none of this is a particular concern to most of the leaders and the primary characters that are involved in the story. Next week, we will explore this daring exploit of Jonathan and his armor bearer as they confront the Philistines at Michmash.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.